wherever you are in West Texas, whether in Lubbock or in Abilene or here at our home in Wichita Falls, we thank you today for listening to the program. This is a show about the culture of America. It is not simply about politics, even though we delve into the politics, but we look at the culture of America, which has, of course, a religious base. There's a lot on store today, in store for us. We have some things I want to say about Organizing for Action. It's an organization that former President Obama, has set up. We want to talk about DACA. That's the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. And we'll be talking with Matt O'Brien from the FAIR organization coming up in just a few moments. And then if we have time at the end of the program, we want to talk about what the Presbyterian Church has done recently in homosexuality, and then some things about natural law. Let's delve right into Organizing for Action. Have you ever seen or ever witnessed a former president of the United States, after leaving office, organizing a huge grassroots campaign in order to overturn the current president's policies and action? No, you have not. Former President Obama is doing exactly that with his Organizing for Action, OFA, in America. Originally, it was labeled Obama for America. It was set up in 2013 when President Obama was still in the White House. And he wanted to continue his activities in stirring up street action with Alinsky-style agitators after he left office. And so, former President Obama is, just as we've always said, a revolutionary Marxist. He has created a communist-style pressure from below to affect society's change. OFA has over 30,000 members. And President Obama, with just a couple of blocks from the White House, where he set up this huge command post, he marshals OFA fellow travelers to ignite chaos all across the country. And I'm saying that the chaos that we are witnessing and the violence that we're witnessing on the streets of America are traceable back to President Obama, former President Obama, and his OFA. New York Post writer Paul Sperry says that Obama has set up a shadow government to sabotage the Trump administration through a network of leftist nonprofits led by OFA. And it has a war chest of more than $40 million. That was Paul Sperry writing in the New York Post almost a year ago. The OFA has 250 offices nationwide. If you look on the website for the OFA, you're going to find the following primary issues around which they're going to work. Number one, climate change. OFA's website says that the street minions, that is those who are to goose step to Obama's orders, are to turn up the heat on climate change deniers, one of which I am. The stakes are too high for us not to act, it is claimed. And so, true to his environmental radical agenda, which is right in sync, by the way, with the United Nations agenda, he is using climate change as the leverage tool to force the wealth out of the hands of Americans into foreign nations, at the same time shutting down American industry. That's progressivism for you. Environmentalism is the mechanism by which socialists wish to control Americans and curtail their freedom. So regulate industry nationally and internationally. Place new controls on business. Ban drilling and ban American-based companies from expanding any drilling operation. Steal money from American businesses through carbon penalties and give it to foreign nations. Malign deniers of government orthodoxy. Yes, Karl Marx would be very proud, wouldn't he? Number two, the OFA website tells us that Obama is after abortion. You know, Obama has always been radically pro-abortion. killing unborn does not bother him in the least. 1997. While he was in the Illinois State Senate, he voted to allow the abominable Herod-like practice of partial birth abortion to continue. In a comment years later, when he was in Pennsylvania at one point campaigning, I don't know if you remember this or heard this, but he was asked a question regarding his own daughters, and he said he wanted his daughters to make good and wise decisions, but if they made a mistake in getting pregnant, he did not want them, quote, punished with a baby. Now, that's the left's view of a child, punished with a baby. Well, perhaps no issue as revealing as this issue is. And what amazes me is that those who proudly enlist in the Democrat Army with the OFA or not with the OFA have really seared their own consciences by supporting this public policy. This is unlike the wrong personal choices that people make in action or in language. When people make wrong personal choices, they have consequences. But Obama said he doesn't want them to suffer the consequences of their own choices. This is a pro-death culture in legislative America. Now, I pointed out it's unlike personal wrong choices. Sometimes people say, well, look here. President Trump has said ugly things about women. He has said ugly things in the past about women. I agree with that. I agree that that is the case. I don't support that. I don't agree with people making ugly comments, no matter what it is, no matter where they are, no matter who that person may be. But a personal comment does not equate with personal, or I should say legislative agenda that Obama is wanting to keep into place. And his OFA is enlisting over 30,000 street goose steppers to keep his legacy intact. That is absolutely Marxist. How about this one? This is on the OFA website. Homosexual deception. True to his Marxist Alinsky-style roots, Obama blatantly, boldly, repeatedly lied in order to manipulate the masses of people. David Axelrod, primary advisor to President Obama in two campaigns for president, said this in his book regarding those days. He said, opposition to gay marriage was particularly strong in the black church. And as he ran for higher office, Obama grudgingly accepted the counsel of more pragmatic folks like me and modified his position to support civil unions rather than marriage, which he would term a sacred union. Now, in other words, translated, this means that Obama lied about his belief that marriage is between a man and a woman. He lied about it in 2008 when he was campaigning for office, all the while deceiving the simple-minded. But that was a calculated lie. According to researcher Charles Scaliger, in 1996, when he was still in Illinois, Obama answered a questionnaire in which he boldly stated that he supported legalizing same-sex marriage and would fight efforts to prohibit such marriages. That's Obama for you. He is a liar, and he is one who is going to get people on the street to try to overturn the Trump presidency. Number four, socialized medicine. Everybody knows that socialized medicine has never been successful in any place where it is tried. Any time that persons compare free market economics and free market health care with socialized medicine, you can see immediately the colossal failure of socialized medicine. Now, America, by the way, I don't know if you knew this or not, but America actually had a trial and error run with socialism when our forefathers first came to the shores of America. The Massachusetts Bay Colony, as well as Jamestown, both of them experimented with socialism. And that is to say that all of the workers were assigned a plot of territory in which they were to, or which they were to work, they were to farm it, and they were to put all of the produce into a receptacle that was kept by the town fathers. That was at Massachusetts Bay, that was at Jamestown as well. What happened? Both colonies, Jamestown established in 1607, Massachusetts Bay in 1620, both colonies almost failed and almost starved to death. That's because that's the nature of socialism. It does not produce. It doesn't produce because people are not having an incentive to work. And the best incentive is the one that God gave us, and that is to defend ourselves and to produce for ourselves and make a living for ourselves. That's what God has placed or put into place for mankind. Well, Massachusetts Bay tried it differently. Jamestown tried it differently, and they almost starved to death. Jamestown was saved by none other than John Smith. But because of all of those practices and those experiments in socialism, our founding fathers wisely rejected and repudiated socialism as a whole, whether it be applied to health care, whether it be applied to food production, whether it be applied to manufacturing, whether it be applied to any business endeavor. They outlawed socialism. Now, I want you to listen to this statement by Samuel Adams. Samuel Adams, here's the father of the American Revolution, knowing exactly what our Constitution was set out to accomplish. And here's how he put it. The utopian schemes of leveling, and he meant by that socialism, and a community of goods are as visionary and impractical as those which vest all property in the crown. These ideas are arbitrary, despotic, and now listen to this. Don't miss this part. And in our government, unconstitutional. End of quote. Of course, former President Obama is not the first or last to push unconstitutional communism, and I'm not pretending that he is. But true to Adams's prediction, Obamacare is arbitrary and despotic. It is arbitrary. How so? Because it removes connection between responsible living and health care. If a person, by his free moral choice, chooses to burn out his brain with drugs or alcohol, those particular personal choices ought not be saddled on those individuals who want to live clean, godly, healthy lives. Obamacare recognizes no such connection between personal responsibility and health care. Personal responsibility and lifestyle choices. Obamacare doesn't recognize that at all. It needs to be absolutely eradicated. The government needs to get out of the business. How about despotic? I said it was, or Sam Adams said it was, that is, socialism is arbitrary and despotic. How is it despotic? Well, Obamacare is a perfect illustration because it is the rulers and bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. that make decision for the patients. Not the patient himself or herself, not the family, not the local community, not the personal doctor, not the personal physician, but government employees sitting at a desk, whether it be a procedure, whether it be medicines to be taken, whether it be what kind of procedures or how many procedures, what doctors one may see or not see, all of that is controlled by the government. That's why Obamacare is a colossal failure. So tax hikes, premium increases of over 100%, in many cases that is, continue to punish people who are working in favor of those who do not work. And loss of health care by millions of Americans because of Obamacare, millions of Americans have lost their health care. What do the president or the former president, what do they care? Those architects of Obamacare, what do they care about that? Very little, if anything at all. And we're not surprised because they don't care about whether or not they kill the unborn. Millions of citizens lose all of these kinds of benefits. They completely disappear under the spiraling deductibles and premiums that we see in healthcare. The American people have rejected these policies of former President Obama, whether it be climate change, abortion, homosexual deception, socialized medicine, whatever it be, by the election of Donald Trump, rejected those things completely. But the sad story is that Organizing for Action, which used to be called, as we pointed out a moment ago, Obama for America, OFA, you look it up, Organizing for Action, is all about signing up people to create chaos on the streets in order to put pressure from below and cause society to change. We've never seen a former president like that, because Obama is not the ordinary man. He is a Marxist, and he is here, and he's going to stay here to create all kinds of turmoil for President Trump. Stand against it. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be talking with Matt O'Brien from FAIR Organization, Federation of Americans for Immigration Reform, talking about the Welcome back. As we before announced, we have a special guest with us today, and he is Matt O'Brien, who writes for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, that is FAIRUS.org. He has some great material here, and we need to talk about the DACA program and what he calls the DACA myth and what Americans need to know. So, Matt, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Listen, I know that this is kind of an evolving story, and this is something that's moving, has a lot of moving parts, and it's moving even today. So before we dig into some of the materials that you have published, do you know what's happening right now as far as the supposed deal with the border security and DACA and all of that right now?
Well, not too much has changed. It seems to be the same situation. You have the Democrats acting as if they're actually holding all the cards, despite the fact that they're not the ones in the White House or in control of either House of Congress. But they seem to be taking a maximalist position and saying that unless they get what they're calling a clean DACA bill, they're not going to give the Republicans anything that the Republicans want, which is mainly a physical barrier on the southern border, an end to chain migration, mandatory use of the E-Verify work verification system, and an end to the diversity visa lottery.
So basically, the Democrats are doing exactly what they've always done, seems to me. That is, we want a clean bill, we want it just the way we want it, and we're not going to play ball if we don't get it. Is that what I'm understanding?
That's it. And the American voters have to be wondering why it is that Congress feels it's appropriate to put the interests of several hundred thousand illegal aliens ahead of the interests of all of the taxpaying voting citizens in the United States.
You know what, Matt? I've been so frustrated, and I give this background sometimes. I'm from Arizona initially, and I remember 25, 30 years ago, my parents and grandparents were all, at that point even, were so disgusted because our federal government seemingly had no backbone to defend our border, to have any physical barrier, or to curtail migration in any substantial form. And we're still at the same place so many years later, and we just don't ever seem to make progress on that. What's really happening here?
Well, I think what's happening is the last amnesty that we did in 1986 under President Reagan in the form of the Immigration Reform and Control Act was supposed to give the people who were here illegally a path to citizenship and then put security in place. Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Except that the promises about security and worksite enforcement and more Border Patrol agents and a longer fence on the border were never honored, And so what we have is the situation that we're in, which the Democrats keep describing as chaotic or our broken immigration system, is largely the result of the 1986 amnesty. But, of course, they don't want average Americans to understand that.
Right, right. Well, and you know what, I'm just, it's so frustrating that that is the case. And I like the way you put it in your article. I think you ended your article with, it's not about just helping people or about deporting DACA kids, but it is about really national security, public safety, economic interest of the United States and the American citizenship over those who violate our immigration laws.
100%. I mean, every parent, every teacher, every police officer understands that if you reward bad behavior, you just get more bad behavior. And so we saw the surges along the border under the Obama administration as he was implementing DACA and talking about doing even broader programs. Why do we believe, especially since we tried this in 1986, that if we do another amnesty, we won't have huge numbers of people coming to the border so that they can get in and try and wait it out for the next amnesty?
Right, right. Well, Matt, where do you see this going with Congress and President Trump? What, do you foresee anything? Or do you fear that a lot of the Republicans are going to be caving in to this?
Well, I think you can go one of three ways. Either the Republicans will cave and we'll wind up with the exact same kind of bad amnesty deal that we had previously. Either Donald Trump is actually the master political manipulator that some people think he is, and he will cause the Democrats to overplay their hand and then essentially in a political sense beat them to death with having shut down the government in the interest of a bunch of illegal aliens. Or it's possible that the Republicans will make a deal. Now, FAIR doesn't support an amnesty, and I think it's a bad idea.
No, I don't either.
The fact is that if the Republicans are going to do it, then they should bargain hard and get the security measures that we've all been waiting for before they consider granting any benefits to any illegal aliens.
You know what? I agree with you. I agree with the FAIR position, and I appreciate the factual material you publish on your website, and I hope people go to it and look at it. You know, you mentioned Ronald Reagan a moment ago. I read a piece by Edwin Meese a few years ago, and I went back and revisited it recently, in which he pointed out that Reagan was disappointed, to say the least of it, in the fact that the security on the border never came about and that we never received from the conservative side what the Democrats had promised. And Edwin Meese suggested this, that he would not do that again. And I agree with that, don't you?
I agree with it 100%. And I think Ronald Reagan, in an interview after his presidency, once said that the only, what he felt was the only blot on his political career was his decision to go forward with an amnesty. He said it was his greatest political mistake.
Is that right? You know what, I've wondered about that. And I just remembered that somewhere in my mind, but I didn't find that, but I've wondered about that particular statement. I appreciate you bringing that up. You know what? Before we move on, Matt, I wonder if you might just explain to the listener what exactly is DACA? And also, while we're going through that, how is it that federal judges can as far as I understand, it's an Obama unilateral policy, and how could federal judges say we can't stop it until Congress acts and so forth? That seems to be so confusing to many people.
Well, to start off, what is DACA? The president was frustrated because he couldn't get the DREAM Act passed. A coalition of Republicans and Democrats had been trying to pass it for two decades and couldn't get it through, which was essentially a mass amnesty for anyone who was ostensibly brought here as a child.
You're talking about Obama. Yeah, okay.
Correct.
Yeah.
So President Obama said, well, I'm going to look at the existing authorities and see if there's a way I can do this administratively. Of course, there isn't, because it's Congress's responsibility to pass the immigration laws. But what he did was he took an existing authority to grant people deferred action, which is a tool for the administrative convenience of the U.S. government, where Homeland Security can simply say, we don't have the resources to deport this person right now because of a diplomatic problem or some other national interest. So we acknowledge the fact that the person is here unlawfully and that they're deportable, but we're not going to take action right now. So it's sort of an administrative stay of execution. And that is typically handled by DHS on a case-by-case basis, and it's rarely exercised. So what President Obama did was stretch that all out of shape and claim that it gave him the authority to essentially neutralize the acts of Congress in the form of the Immigration and Nationality Act and grant a unilateral amnesty by executive fiat.
Well, how could a judge, now I understand, I believe I saw a ticker tape on Fox News the other day that said that a federal judge has said that President Trump cannot stop this DACA program until it has been decided upon by Congress. Now, am I understanding that correctly?
You are understanding that correctly. I'm an attorney. I was a trial attorney for Immigration and Customs Enforcement for years. No one seems to understand where federal judges are deriving this power that they claim they have. What it basically is activism from the bench, and you have a judge that thinks DACA was a good idea and is basically making up legal regulations to support his personal feeling that this is a great program. And he took the unusual step of filing a brief with the Supreme Court in regards to this case. Judges usually don't file briefs in cases that they're involved in.
Oh, is that right? So he filed the brief himself.
He did. He filed a brief reacting to the court's decision that the government was not required to turn over materials about how it made the decision to end the DACA program. And essentially, the brief was just him criticizing the government and criticizing U.S. immigration policy. So I think there's a serious question as to whether this individual is meeting his oath that he swore when he sat down on the bench, because the job of judges in the United States is to interpret and apply the law, not to change it if they think it's incorrect.
You know what, Matt? I we're about to go to break here, but I do want to say that it seems that this is a larger problem than simply the immigration problem. It's a problem with the courts and these judges that are absolutely out of control legislating from the bench. And it just is infuriating to the American citizen, such as myself, that that would be the case. But listen, let's take a break. And when we come back, I'd like for you to explain just a little bit more about some of the details of DACA, because as your article points out, there are a lot of myths about it. And what people think is the deferred action for childhood arrivals is really childhood is really kind of a misnomer in a lot of cases with it. So we'll come back. We're talking with Matt O'Brien, and he represents Federation for American Immigration Reform. We'll be back in just a moment. DACA program, back in a minute. Welcome back. Our guest is Matt O'Brien. Matt O'Brien works for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. He has great articles on their website. You can go to it, fairus.org. That's fairus.org. And his latest article is The DACA Myth, What Americans Need to Know. But before we delve into some of the DACA facts, Matt, you had some things to say regarding your own personal involvement in the government. I thought was really interesting and puts a personal face on it for the listener. I wonder if you would share some of that with us.
Sure. Way back in 1996, when I first got out of law school, I went to work for the Immigration and Naturalization Service. After that, I went into private practice of immigration law for a while, so I'm familiar with these issues from both sides. After the September 11th attacks, I went back to work for the government with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, where I was a trial attorney, and I was essentially the prosecutor in deportation proceedings. After working there for a while, I moved to D.C. and went to work for Citizenship and Immigration Services, which took over the application and adjudication functions of the old INS. And when I left government service, I was the chief of the National Security Division at USCIS, which is part of essentially the investigative arm of USCIS that runs all the background checks and conducts the field interviews and all of those kind of things that go along with the vetting process.
That is a very interesting background. You know, I was going to ask you, where did you go to law school? Out there on the East Coast somewhere?
Yes, I went to the little tiny University of Maine Law School. But at the time I was there, I think had about 150 students.
Okay. Well, listen, regarding DACA, and you, we haven't really broken it down as you did in your article. I wonder if you might do that, because a lot of people think that DACA is about children and these kids, that they are in our country. They've never known their own country from which their parents came and so forth. And but you point out that many of them are actually grown-ups and not just children. And I wonder if you can explain a little bit of that to us.
Sure, almost all of them are adults. Their average age is 27. So according to the Obama administration, these kids were all valedictorians and distinguished veterans of the U.S. Armed Services. And so this program was protecting children who, through no fault of their own, had been brought here to the United States, wouldn't be able to understand the language in their home country, and wouldn't understand the customs in their home country. Now, the problem is that only about half of them have a high school diploma. There's only about 21% of them that have gone on to earn a bachelor's degree. Less than 1% of them have been in the military, and we weren't able to find any skills on, any statistics on how many of them were valedictorians. They also have an issue where most of them do, in fact, speak their native language. They speak it better than they speak English. And they're also, rather than being people who are driving the new high-tech economy, tend to be low-skill, low-wage workers, and the primary two jobs that they occupy are in the food services and the construction industries.
Right. Now, on your article also, in your article, you point out that a lot of them have had criminal backgrounds, and that's a problem also.
That's correct. So supposedly you were not supposed to have any felony convictions, and you weren't supposed to have convictions for any serious misdemeanors or multiple misdemeanors in order to be eligible for the program. You were also supposed to have attended school in the United States. And since this is a fake program that the Obama administration made up, it essentially ignored its own requirements and waived those in a lot of cases. The other problem is, rather than doing the full national security public safety vetting on this cohort, they were subjected to what's called lean and light vetting, which were checks that didn't give the adjudicators handling these cases adequate information to determine whether anybody qualified for the program. But therein lies the danger. If you make up your own program, basically you can give the benefit to anybody you want because there aren't any real rules.
You know, one of the things that has concerned me, just by bending all these rules, the lean and light vetting process, as you call it, Matt, or as Obama administration called it, actually, the whole problem is we're just overloaded in middle America. Our school systems are absolutely overcrowded with the Hispanic population that comes from south of the border. Then we have not only that, but in our jail systems, they're crowded with these illegals who are committing high rates of crimes as far as percentages go. Then you have also the medical facilities being overcrowded. I remember growing up in Phoenix that it came about that, you know, you couldn't even get into an emergency room. You just have to wait in line because there were so many people that were illegal in line for just getting a routine doctor visit. And just on and on it goes as far as the burdening of our system.
Well, the most recent statistics, I believe, say that 93% of the hospitals in the border regions have closed because under the Emergency Treatment and Labor Act called EMTALA, they were unable to keep up with providing these services but not being paid for them, which has a downstream impact on the people that live in those areas because most Americans, even in rural areas in the United States, have access to decent hospitals and decent health care. But largely because of the immigration policies the United States has pursued, foolish policies, people who are living in the border zone don't have access to that kind of medical care anymore. They have to travel when they're seeking non-urgent medical care, and they have to be med-flighted by a helicopter in a lot of cases if they suffer a traumatic injury in a car accident or something of that nature.
So you said 93% of the hospitals on the border have closed?
90 to 93%. I'm not sure of the exact statistics.
Wow, but, that is absolutely astounding.
It is, and it's frightening when you think that this was almost solely the result of poor immigration policies.
You know, I'm a preacher, and I preach in the Churches of Christ, Matt, and I've preached in congregations where we had a Hispanic minister also, and I never will forget. He came and told me. He says that his people consider it to be Reconquista, and he would just talk about it openly. And I was like, "What? I don't know. There may be a little strain here, but it sounds like whether or not intentional or not, that's exactly what's happening in some of those southern borders."
Well, the first duty of government is to protect its citizens. That's why we have a government in the first place. And when it comes to immigration, the United States government is clearly failing at that task. And what's frightening, you know, with the events that we've seen around Washington this week is that Donald Trump won the presidency almost solely on the basis of his immigration enforcement policies. And since he's been in office, he's been very good at spreading the message that America is getting serious about enforcing its immigration laws as written. However, that could all fall away if he all of a sudden changes his stance and starts backing a dangerous amnesty, because any type of amnesty will send a clear message to people who are in countries that are not nearly as pleasant as the U.S., like Venezuela, which is on the verge of collapse, that it's time to go to the U.S., because if you get there and you avoid the authorities long enough, you'll eventually get the golden ticket, a green card.
Yeah, and I think that you have mentioned in your article that a lot of them come from Pakistan, Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, countries that we've had travel bans against, and yet these are some of the DACA people as well.
It's insane, and as I mentioned, those people from those areas were subjected to these lean and light background checks rather than full-blown background checks. There's also a large number of people with gang affiliations from Latin America who managed to squeeze in through this program. It makes no sense, and I'm not sure why the politicians in the United States feel that they have some moral obligation to reward these people for their parents' bad behavior or for their own bad behavior. And one of the really pernicious aspects of the DACA myth is that these kids were all brought in here when they had no choice, when they were young. In fact, a significant majority of them were brought here when they were teenagers and were old enough to understand. And when we say brought in, it means their parents paid to have them smuggled into the United States, which is yet another violation of our laws.
Yeah, and then as you mentioned earlier, they know their own native language. So the real key here is they need to go back and get in line with the rest of the people.
Exactly, and that's an important point you bring up, because people who are in India and the Philippines obeying the law are waiting, you know, anywhere from 10 to 25 years in order to be able to come to the United States lawfully. And one of the reasons those people are so delayed is because we keep doing things like the 86 amnesty, which was extended umpteen times. I think they finally finished dealing with it in the early 2000s. That makes all of the people who are obeying the laws in other countries wait longer and longer in order to be able to come here lawfully.
Hey, Matt, have you heard of Senator Rand Paul's suggestion, and that would be that if there's any kind of DACA deal, then that would be also the reducing of the numbers. He said, I think I heard him say that we've taken about 1 million immigrants per year, and that would be taking off that number right off the top, whatever DACA people that we allow to stay, just take it right off the top. Have you heard of that, or is that?
I have. I think it's a fantastic idea, but it's only putting a Band-Aid on the gushing wound, because we have had record numbers of immigrants coming into the United States, and I think we hit the all-time record in 2016 or 2017 for the biggest immigrant population we've ever had living in the U.S. And if you do these small stopgap measures, it does help the problem, but the question is, why are we bringing so many people into the United States where we still have poverty, we still have unemployment, we still have economic issues? The average American citizen whose family has worked all their lives can't afford to send their kids to school to go to college. So why are we filling up our population with people who don't understand our language and culture and are dependent upon services from the moment that they get here?
You know, Matt, I agree with you. I really do. And I appreciate your clear-spokenness about it and your plain-spokenness and your articles. I hope people go to fairus.org and read your articles about it. Listen, what would you have people do to help this and get involved in the fight? What would you think we need to do?
Sure. Well, the first and most important thing is to contact your legislators and tell them how you feel. And that goes for state and local legislators about sanctuary city policies. It goes for your federal legislators about the DACA deal and any other angle of immigration policy that needs to be straightened out. The other thing that folks can do is reach out and find local activist groups. There are local activist groups in almost every state where like-minded people come together to discuss these things and make plans of action, organize letter-writing campaigns, organize protests, and all of those type of things. And it's very important because we live in a democracy where the government is the people, and the people need to make their desires known to the politicians.
So contact legislators, National Definitely. And local, and get involved in an active group.
Correct.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, Matt, thank you so much for being here today, and I want to have you back whenever we can, and thank you for your good research and all your background in it. Appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on, and God bless.
Okay, God bless you. Thank you, Matt. In just a few moments I have remaining, I wanted to turn attention to what is taking place in the Presbyterian Church. This is reported by The Blaze recently, and it reads, inclusive language to accommodate same-sex wedding ceremonies will be featured in the Presbyterian Church USA's 2018 version of the Book of Common Worship. So it was reported also in the Christian Post. The new language is in response to the denomination amending its definition of marriage to include same-sex marriage. David Gambrell of the PCUSA Presbyterian Mission Agency and co-editor of the new Book of Common Worship told the outlet. So what has the definition changed to? The majority of the Presbyterian Church USA in 2015 voted in favor of altering the definition of marriage from a man and a woman to, quote, two people, traditionally a man and a woman. Then we have a revised marriage service features inclusive language and a flexible format, making the service useful for all sorts of couples and family configurations, end of quote. That's what Presbyterians Today reported in regard to the new language in the Book of Common Worship. 2011, the PCUSA denomination ordained its first openly gay minister. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is how far gone are the churches in America. This is how far gone. The Bible is exceedingly clear regarding homosexuality, that it is sinful, that it is a choice, but nevertheless, you have the churches that supposedly are to preach the Bible are going to stand up for our culture and stand up for the direction of our culture as it falls into the gutter. No society in the history of mankind that has put homosexual marriage or encoded it into law and made it a part of the common law and a part of its culture has survived. And we will not survive if we continue on the hedonistic fashion that we're going. How can people pretend that they follow the Bible in any way, shape, or form in such face of such passages as Romans chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, or Leviticus chapter 18, all of the passages which are exceedingly clear that homosexuality is sinful, and Paul depicts it in Romans chapter 1 as occurring when God has given up a society. Is that where America is? Apparently so. It goes back to what I've said from day one when I stepped into this radio studio. What America needs is not simply a reversal of its political process or changing some of the politics that go on in America, but we need a cultural revolution going back to God and back to the Bible, because if we do not, it makes no difference what we do in the political field. Our society will be doomed. The website is American Liberty with Bill Lockwood.com. If you're in Wichita Falls, of course, it's KWFS News Talk 1290. NewsTalk1290.com is the website. In Abilene, it's KYYW 1470. That's 1470KYYW.com. And if you're in Lubbock, it's KFYO News Talk 790, KFYO.com. I also want to make mention of the fact that I myself have a book out. It is called Ezekiel, the Watchman of Israel, a study guide. It is a study guide regarding the Old Testament prophetic book of Ezekiel. It's about 150, 160 pages, something like that. And you can buy it on Amazon.com. And for those who are, I call it for those who are serious Bible students, you want to study the Bible, and here is a book that really is a guide. It's not a commentary. It's not simply my blogs on Ezekiel. It is a study guide that helps you step through the book of Ezekiel and examine some of those very critical issues, as well as some of controversial issues, such as Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39. So Amazon.com is where you can buy that book. So go to our website. You can find everything here at American Liberty with BillLockwood.com. We thank you today for listening.